Hello, this is Dr. David Friedman, host of To Your Good Health Radio. Here's a sobering reality check. Autoimmune disease is at an all-time high. Cardiovascular disease still remains the number one killer. And we're seeing a massive rise in obesity, diabetes, depression, brain fog, and chronic fatigue. But what if I told you that a big piece of this puzzle traces back to one place? Your gut. Your microbiome isn't just about digestion. It helps coordinate your immune system, your heart, hormones, mood, and your metabolism. Sadly, the modern diet has been quietly destroying our gut for decades. Joining us next is Dr. William Davis, a listener favorite, making his fifth appearance on the show. And every time he's here, he leaves everyone rethinking their food choices, their medicine cabinets, and their entire approach to health. And today we're discussing his latest book, Super Body. You may not be able to leap tall buildings in a single bound, but Dr. Davis is here to transform your inner Clark Kent into Superbody. Don't go anywhere. The conversation could be the turning point your health has been waiting for, and it all starts now.
It's To Your Good Health Radio with number one best-selling author and renowned wellness expert, Dr. David Friedman, changing lives just for the health of it.
Our next guest is a board-certified cardiologist, a relentless health advocate, and one of the most influential voices in functional and nutritional medicine. He's the number one New York Times bestselling author behind the popular Wheat Belly series of books, which have empowered millions to reclaim their health by rethinking what's on their plate. As a true pioneer in microbiome-based therapies, he's the co-founder and chief medical officer of Realize Therapeutics, a company dedicated to advancing cutting-edge research into microbiome science. He's also the creator behind the popular Dr. Davis Infinite Health website and the host of Defiant Health Radio podcast. I'm excited to have him back to discuss his latest book, Superbody, a three-week program to harness the new science of body composition and restore your youthful contours. Welcome back to the show, Dr. William Davis.
Thank you, Dr. Friedman. Always glad to be back.
Yeah, congrats on your book. Now, last time you were here, we teased the listeners about Superbody was coming out, and I was lucky to get my hands on a pre-published copy and an excellent book. Now it's available. We can dive in and first share what you've built this legacy writing about wheat, grains, and gut health. What motivated you to go into full Superbody restoration?
You know, a number of things, including I started to see dramatic improvements in the way people look, their shape and body composition, but it's all been brought to a head, unfortunately, in the shadow of this horrible trend of people adopting the GLP-1 agonist drugs. What they're not being told, they're told that, yeah, you take this drug, you may pay thousands of dollars per month, but you're going to lose all kinds of weight. You're going to look great. A woman's going to fit in a size 6 dress, all that sort of thing. What they're not told, of course, is that of the weight you lose, and this is true not just of GLP-1 agonists, it's true of any method that involves reducing calories. We could call it a diet program. We could call it a bariatric procedure like lap band or gastric bypass, or we could call it Wegovy or Mounjaro. But they're all variations on the same theme, which is to reduce your intake of calories. And we have the advantage now of 20 years of science that has made it crystal clear. When you reduce calorie intake, yes, you'll lose weight in the beginning, and of that weight, 25% will be muscle. Now, that has long-term implications. We now know great science from our own National Institutes of Health, the NIH. They have done several studies. In other words, not biased by the interests of big pharma that are exploitative and predatory. So the NIH has published now, including a study called the Biggest Loser Study, where they took people who graduated the 8th season of that TV show, 2015, and measured their basal metabolic rate, that is the rate at which their bodies burn energy. And they showed that at the time of leaving the show, their basal metabolic rate was 27% reduced, that is, they needed fewer calories, because your body is smart. It thinks you're starving. When you take in fewer calories, and in this case, engage in extreme exercise efforts, your body thinks you're living in the wild and you're starving. So to keep you alive, it cuts back on its energy requirements. Now, they test these people at time of graduation, and then, remarkably, 6 years later, and that reduction in BMR, in basal metabolic rate, persisted for 6 years. For all practical purposes, it's a long-term, perhaps a permanent effect. So I talked to one of the graduates. I talked to the guy, Danny Cahill, very graciously talked to me. He was the winner. He won the $250,000 prize because he lost 239 pounds. 239 pounds. In 7 months, you know, this idea that people are obese because they're lazy and over. Well, this guy was incredibly committed. 800 calories per day, as many as 6 hours per day. 6 hours per day of exercise, aerobic and resistance training. Loses that extraordinary amount of weight. He looks terrific. By the way, all the other graduates on stage were all wearing Spanx underneath their clothes because they had such extensive loose skin flaps that are often surgically removed, by the way. Anyway, he leaves the show. He goes home. He tells me he kept up a 2 hours per day, 6 days a week exercise program. Resistance and aerobic, maintained a low-calorie lifestyle, regained all the weight. And he'd go back every year to the reunion that the producers of the TV show would host, and he saw all the other graduates doing the same, all regaining the weight. And that's because when you lose muscle, your basal metabolic rate drops, and even if you maintain a very strenuous program, you will regain the weight, and you'll regain it as fat, not as muscle. So we know, for instance, in the GLP-1 agonist data, such as the large UK Wilding study, that people took semaglutide, lost huge amounts of weight. It does work. When they stopped the drug, because most people can't afford it forever, it's very expensive, they regained most of the weight as almost nearly all fat. And if you went back and compared how many type 2 diabetics, pre-diabetics, people with hypertension, fatty liver, etc., resulted at the end of the experience off the drug, there were more after the weight loss than there were before. And we also know from great evidence from the NIH, when that happens, we now have NIH data, NHANES data, Epic Norfolk data, Asprey data, large databases of people who've engaged in weight loss by reducing calories. In aggregate, 60,000 people, we now know that you're going to die several years younger. So the FDA approved a class of drugs that, yes, achieve near-term weight loss, generate guaranteed fat regain, and you're likely to die several years younger. And your last few years are not glorious years. They're plagued by falls, fractures, frailty, loss of independence, acceleration of cognitive impairment, and then death several years before you should have died. This is what the conventional answer has gotten us.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up because I've been finding there's an increase in hip fractures in elderly that are going on these GLP-1s because, as you mentioned, they're losing their muscular ability and they fall. And it's, yeah, they look thin, but you know what? So does a corpse. So it's not just looking thin. You got to be healthy, right?
You know, Dr. Friedman, so far, recently, 3,000 lawsuits have been filed against the manufacturers, the GLP-1 agonists. Many of them, by the way, for optic neuritis, people who have gone blind on those drugs, as well as bowel obstruction, a surgical emergency, thyroid cancer, intractable gastroparesis where the stomach is paralyzed, those two, but also blindness. But I'm waiting to see, I'm sad to say, I'm waiting for the class action suits. When people start to recognize, as you point out, you stop the drug or you take it for long enough, it's not all roses. It's a deterioration of health and programmed premature death. Yet pharma pockets billions of dollars to do this, and we have colleagues dispensing this stuff like candy because they did not read the science. They don't understand what's happening. They just think the near-term weight loss is good enough.
Yeah, and something I'll share, I had a patient come in yesterday. I hadn't seen her in about a year and didn't recognize her. She looked 20 years older, but you know what? She lost 65 pounds on these GLP-1s. So, yeah, she was thinner, but they call it what, Ozempic face. They're getting older looking. And the pads in there, it was like, you know what? I'd rather not look 20 years older and have some excess weight than I would be and look like an old woman. And she's young. And it was like, it's awful. Like you said, you got to do it in a conscious effort. And one other thing you mentioned in your book is conventional dieters, the GLP-1s, the popular now. But, man, there's some conventional diets out there that work against us. Why is that failing? Why are they missing the mark?
probably because of this theme that runs through all most methods of losing weight, that is the loss of muscle. So recall, your listeners will recall that if you lose 25% of the weight lost as muscle on a GLP-1 agonist or bariatric procedure or on a diet program, it compounds the weight loss of aging. In other words, from age 30 to age 65, 70, you lost about a third of your muscle, which is a lot. You accelerate, you amplify that effect with these efforts to lose weight. And of course, if someone yo-yo dieted, which is a lot of people, right? Every time you lose more muscle, and we know muscle is, we need to guard muscle like gold. It's so valuable, so important to health. Because we see the people who can't go up a flight of stairs, who can't get in and out of a car easily, who can't carry their own groceries, who use a cane walker or motorized scooter just to go grocery shopping. They can't. And what's happened in this world is we've accelerated. We've increased the number of people who are going to succumb to those kinds of conditions. Yet, it's a tough trend to reverse because too many people are making oodles of money. It's pharma, of course, but it's also plastic surgeons, dermatologists, estheticians, and other people who take those people with the Ozempic face because they've lost both subcutaneous fat and muscle in their face. They look, as you point out, 20 years older. Well, now the estheticians, and dermatologists, and all those people come to their rescue with thousands of dollars worth of filler injections, red light, microneedling, plastic surgery, all in an effort to undo, but you can't undo the health and life-shortening effects just by injecting some filler, say.
Yeah, that's so true. I know you've been sounding the alarm about the damaged modern microbiome for years, and I'm curious, what are the top culprits silently destroying our gut health that most people don't suspect, and how is that related to our overall weight? It's definitely an issue.
I fear that there's a lot we know and there's a lot we don't know. So obviously, our wild overexposure to antibiotics, there's a time and place for antibiotics, of course. But the CDC tells us that by age 40, most of us have taken 30 courses of antibiotics. For every 1,000 children, over 1,300 prescriptions for antibiotics are written every year. In the U.S., 650,000 prescriptions are written for antibiotics every day. Now, sometimes it's needed. If you have pneumococcal pneumonia, you'd likely need an antibiotic. If you had a bladder infection that ascended to your kidneys, then entered the bloodstream, sepsis, you need an antibiotic, no question. But the overuse of antibiotics for such things as a viral respiratory infection has led to decimation of the gastrointestinal microbiome. We know with good evidence, very good evidence in humans, one antibiotic, let's say 7 days worth of clarithromycin or a similar drug, wipes out literally hundreds of species, but not pathogenic species, species that are beneficial to human health, species like Lactobacillus, Bifidobacteria, Fecalobacterium, Acromantia. But they're generally ineffective at killing fecal microbes. So antibiotics, as well as other factors like glyphosate, the active ingredient in the herbicide Roundup and other herbicides, are very good at killing beneficial microbes and ineffective at killing fecal microbial species. These are species that your listeners will recognize. E. coli, Salmonella, Campylobacter, because these are also the species, by the way, of food poisoning. So humans and other mammals, they don't adapt to fecal microbes very well when they're outside the colon. So if you eat some food from a fast food joint and the kid went number two and didn't wash his hands and contaminated your food or something like that, fecal microbes in the upper GI tract make you very sick. Diarrhea, vomiting, fever, etc. But likewise, when there's an overpopulation of fecal microbes in the colon that's adapted to these fecal microbes, but then because of their overproliferation, they ascend into the 24 feet of small intestine. Small intestine is not well adapted to having trillions of fecal microbes within. And the small intestine is, by its very nature, very permeable. That's where we absorb nutrients. But when you have the infestation of trillions of fecal microbes, it increases its permeability, and those fecal microbes release their toxic compounds, like endotoxins, part of their cell wall. And that enters the bloodstream, endotoxemia. And that is a major driver of the expansion of abdominal fat, obesity, type 2 diabetes, cognitive impairment, risk for numerous diseases, including, as you point out, autoimmune diseases, which are on fire, like Hashimoto's thyroiditis. In other words, this mess we've created through antibiotics and other factors has caused the overproliferation. By the way, this applies to over half the U.S. population. I used to think this was rare, this process that we label small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, of course, SIBO, we say SIBO. I thought it was rare until we started looking for it with a consumer device that became available a few years ago, the AIRE device, A-I-R-E, and of course, with other forms of formal testing. And we're seeing that easily, conservatively estimated, over half the U.S. population has this process. But as you know, our conventional colleagues don't look for it. They'd rather give you a biologic for $4,000 to $12,000 a month, for your rheumatoid arthritis, for your psoriatic arthritis, for whatever condition. So in other words, if we can address a problem and it's almost without cost, there's no pot of gold, there's no reward, there's no pharma that's reaping billions of dollars for some purported solution. And yet, it's important to note that this is a process created by modern life, and it's a process we can correct with some basic strategies.
Yeah, I know some people are probably hearing says, oh, he mentions, you know, top is antibiotic damage. And they say, well, I don't take antibiotics, but they do inadvertently, don't they? And meat they could be getting. It's not just that they're going out into the pharmacy. They could be getting that elsewhere, correct?
Exactly. Meat, yes, other foods. Of course, glyphosate is ubiquitous. It's in your water, air, hair, skin, clothing. How about microplastics? We now know with pretty good evidence that microplastics and nanoplastics, even small that you can't see, are major disruptors, probably of the mucus barrier, and it's in your food. So one of the most offensive, this is horrible to say, but one of the most offensive foods for the presence of microplastics are carrots, apples, lettuce. So in other words, here we think we have a big green salad with extra virgin olive oil and some balsamic vinegar. You may be adding a huge burden of microplastics to your gastrointestinal tract, and that also has disruptive effects. As do preservatives in food, like sodium benzoate, potassium sorbate. They're antimicrobial in your food. They keep out mold and fungi, but they also kill off microbes in your GI tract. Other food additives, like polysorbate 80 and carboxymethylcellulose, that is, emulsifying agents that emulsify your mucus barrier, in which, ironically, the prep used for a colonoscopy in the cause of hopefully preventing, or at least identifying early colon cancer, the PrEP they use is a major disruptor of the gastrointestinal microbiome, an effect that persists days, if not weeks and months. So we have this world conspiring to screw up your gastrointestinal microbiome.
I just got this vision of the fireman putting out the fire and there's a little bit of gasoline in the water. That's the colonoscopy. Putting out the fire, but they got gasoline. Oh, that's disgusting.
and you know, I don't take this idea that the gastroenterology community says, well, you need to have a colonoscopy periodically to prevent colon cancer. Why aren't they also informing people that the presence of a microbe, Fusobacterium nucleatum, that got its start in the mouth in people, especially with bleeding gums, gingivitis, periodontitis, that this microbe, Fusobacterium, enters the bloodstream and then colonizes the colon. And the evidence, it's hard to prove in a human. If I said, hey, to somebody, I'm going to give you a capsule. It could have Fusobacterium nucleatum. It could be placebo. I'm going to watch you for 10 years, see if you die of colon cancer. So no one's going to do that. But we know that Fusobacterium, for instance, if we take a piece of colon cancer taken out of somebody's colon, it's filled with Fusobacterium. If we take that same microbe and put it in a mouse or rat's colon, it will get colon cancer. So the evidence is pretty good that this microbe, well, if you're going to purport to prevent colon cancer, why aren't you talking about testing saliva and stool for Fusobacterium, especially since Fusobacterium is also known to be a factor in dementia and in breast cancer.
By the way, I'm glad you brought up the microplastics. I read an interesting story, a study that microplastics every week is equivalent to a credit card that you're consuming. That's a lot of plastics we're eating. And then you got 97% that they say have high levels of the PFAS forever chemicals in their bloodstream. These are linked to not just weight gain, but hormonal chaos and diseases. I'm curious, we can't escape them, but is there any low-hanging fruit changes people can make right now to reduce this exposure?
You make an excellent point. it's become almost impossible to avoid them. All we can hope to do is to minimize our exposure. So do things like, if you have the luxury of a backyard, grow your own vegetables. You're not going to spray Roundup on it. You might use some cow manure or some other organic type things. Buy whenever you can organic. Even that's not a guarantee, but it does reduce your exposure to PFAS and to microplastics. Filter drinking water, of course, using a filter, either charcoal or even better, reverse osmosis to remove microplastics, pharmaceuticals, heavy metals, etc. Of course, try to choose real foods, not processed, ultra-processed foods, which are just havens for those kinds of ingredients. But it is very, it's one of the most difficult things I've ever encountered. That is, if we want to go wheat and grain free, that's pretty easy. We can accomplish that. We want to limit our sugar exposure. Okay, that's pretty easy. We want to supplement omega-3 fatty acids or vitamin D. Okay, that's doable. But to minimize exposure to these ubiquitous compounds that are in everything from air to water to clothing to your kitchen counters to your children's bloodstream to a newborn's umbilical cord, it's everywhere. All we can do is try to reduce it.
Yeah, that makes sense. We talked about autoimmune disease on the rise. It's been described as the body attacking itself. But from an evolutionary standpoint, that doesn't make a lot of sense. We're talking about a defense system refined over millions of years. Why would it suddenly go rogue on the very host it's designed to protect? Can you enlighten us on what's actually happening in an autoimmune response?
I know of several factors we could begin to blame. One is a shift in the composition of the gliadin protein of wheat. So this goes back to my wheat belly days. But we know that agribusiness scientists shifted the composition, the amino acid sequence of the gliadin protein. Gliadin is the protein within gluten that's one of the truly offensive things in wheat and grains. And they tweaked the amino acid sequence to make it more immunogenic. We know this with good confidence, that the new forms of gliadin protein that emerged on the market in the 1980s are more effective at generating autoimmune disease, and probably, now this is a bit speculative, and more likely to generate the opioid peptides, the 4 or 5 amino acid long peptide fragments that come from the partial digestion of the gliadin protein, because we can't digest it completely. We don't have the enzymes to do that. So the gliadin protein is reduced to 4 or 5 amino acid long peptide fragments that do travel to the brain and bind to opioid receptors and activate appetite. They're appetite stimulants. But the gliadin protein that's been changed, we know, is a more potent stimulant of the immune response. There's also this endotoxemia problem I mentioned. That is, when you have a flood of endotoxin to the bloodstream, it tends to activate autoimmune diseases. So we're seeing a lot more, for instance, Hashimoto's thyroiditis in people who have endotoxemia. So, yeah, you could give somebody radioactive iodine, you could remove their thyroid, all that nasty stuff that is largely inappropriate. Or you could just say, well, how did this happen in the first place? And one of the things that has to be addressed is this surge in endotoxemia. One of the frustrations with documented endotoxemia is the tests we use tend to be indirect, like breath, measurement of breath, hydrogen gas, or stool analysis. Stool analysis is very helpful, very useful, but it can't be used to locate where microbes are dwelling. In other words, when you get a stool sample, it's from the rectum. It's not from the ileum. It's not from the jejunum. So we can only speculate what's going on when we do a stool analysis. So it's all indirect. The direct test would be a serum or plasma lipopolysaccharide endotoxin measurement. Unfortunately, the FDA has seen fit to not allow us to use that clinically. It's available. I do it as part of clinical studies, but we can't do it clinically. Their reservation, So they say, is that it is not effective. It's an antibody-driven test, and doesn't identify the full spectrum of lipopolysaccharide. But I'll tell you, it's one of those tests where if we could do it and your level is elevated, we know that you have endotoxemia. If it's not elevated, you still could have endotoxemia. But then you can look at the entire clinical picture and say, well, despite the negative was one test, I still think you have it. So it would be useful, but we right now can't get access to it outside of a clinical study.
Yeah, that's right. I know in all the times you've been on the show, I don't think we've discussed cholesterol, so I didn't want to miss that this time. There's so much confusion right now. Experts say people with higher cholesterol are healthier, and the old total cholesterol HDL, LDL models are dinosaur medicine. As a cardiologist, what is the real truth about cholesterol? And maybe briefly kind of discuss triglycerides, which I believe gets too little attention.
Oh, I like your idea of dinosaur medicine. So I tell my listeners, here's how we manage cholesterol. Get a big, thick black magic marker and cross out total cholesterol and LDL cholesterol, two garbage pieces of data that never should have been construed to be cause of coronary disease. They weren't. They are not cause of coronary disease. They are at most meant to be crude, indirect markers to guesstimate the lipoproteins, fat-carrying proteins, in the bloodstream that actually do cause heart disease. You know what? The original researchers, Dr. William Fredericks and Friedewald, at the NIH in the 1950s, knew this. They pretty much knew this. Yet they developed this idea that you could use cholesterol, this one component. So lipoproteins have many, many, many things in them. They're very complex particles. They're part of the way your body transacts energy. And in these lipoprotein particles, of which there are many different kinds, there's proteins and fats and phospholipids and all kinds of things. In 1958, when they first started studying this stuff, they said, well, how do we actually count the number of particles? Because it's likely that more particles you have, the more likely it is leads to heart disease, coronary disease. Well, how do you do that in 1958? Crude technology, well, they didn't know how. So what they did was they said, let's pick one component of those lipoproteins and use it as an indirect way to quantify these lipoproteins. They chose cholesterol. Unfortunately, that was interpreted by many people as cholesterol is the cause of heart disease. It's not a cause. It was a crude marker for the number of particles that do cause heart disease. The tragedy is that everybody put all their attention on saturated fat, LDL cholesterol, statin drugs, because pharma made a trillion dollars off that industry. And now we're left with the real cause of heart disease that almost nobody, at least until recently, was paying attention to. And this is why, of course, even though 80 million Americans take a statin cholesterol drug, there's been no meaningful reduction in heart disease. That's why your hospital added a $80 million new wing for cardiovascular care, trumpeting, oh, brand new heart center. What? Because heart disease, as you know, remains the number one killer of men and women in the U.S. and the rest of the world, and the number one moneymaker for the healthcare system. Despite all the conversation about cholesterol, there's been no impact at all on reducing because it makes money. Why would you turn off this spigot of profit? Because if you did, how are you going to pay your mortgage and your children's, how are you going to drive your Maserati? So when money is involved, it's very difficult to turn this Titanic around.
Yeah, you heard it from the horse's mouth. There you go. Well explained. One thing I would talk to you about is recently this cooking oil debate, especially seed oils, because that topic's now become a real roller coaster. The seed oil debate's going viral and people were confused. It's like, now it's okay. Where do you stand on these oils?
I think what's clear is seed oils, omega-6, linoleic acid forms are not all that great for you, but they're not all that harmful either, unless you wildly overconsume them, as you would say by going to fast food or eating processed, ultra-processed foods, or you allow them to replace or substitute for truly beneficial fats like saturated fat or monounsaturated fats like olive oil, or omega-3 fatty acids like in fish oil and linoleic acid in other foods. So in other words, in some ways, the excess of linoleic acid, omega-6s, serves as a proxy for the absence of beneficial oils. So yes, excess omega-6 probably is modestly harmful. When we weigh the pros and cons of things, it's not as if everything that's bad is really bad and everything that's good is really good. There are grades in between. So for instance, omega-3 fatty acids, we now know, are beneficial, even though there's been 20, 30 years of debate. We now know they're beneficial. How beneficial? Well, moderately beneficial. Not maybe hugely beneficial, but moderately beneficial. How about the linoleic acid, plant source of omega-3, is minimally helpful. So there's always grades. And in the world of linoleic acid, omega-6s, they're probably modestly harmful, but not to the degree that some alarmists are saying. Not to say you should pour canola oil, soybean oil, safflower oil, sunflower oil on all your food. No, we'll get those from other foods. You want to weigh your diet in favor of the fats from animals, from butter, from olive oil, from other natural sources, and certainly not the seed processed oils.
I'm glad you brought olive oil because, you know, I've interviewed all the plant-based cardiologists and oddly, they say avoid extra virgin olive oil. Their argument is it damages arteries, but You look at Mediterranean cultures, olive oil is a dietary staple, and their cardiovascular disease is pretty remarkably low. That contradiction has always boggled me. As a cardiologist who looks at the full picture, what's the real story? Yes or no? Olive oil good for the heart?
Absolutely. The evidence is really incontrovertible. 40 years ago, I heard Dr. Dean Ornish, actually, talk about his lifestyle heart trial and how he claims to have reversed coronary disease with a 10% or less fat diet, vegetarian. And he claims to have reversed, and by the way, he did not. He misinterpreted the evidence. It was a very sloppily performed study, and he did not reverse heart disease despite that claim. And in fact, there were an abundance of heart attacks, death, bypass surgery, hospitalizations in his population that purportedly achieved. So anyway, but I bought it. I stupidly bought it. I was in my 30s. So this is a long, long time ago because I heard him talk and I thought, well, let's give this a try. I did it. I had patients do it, hundreds of them do it. And what I saw was triglycerides went way up, HDL plummeted, small LDL, the real cause, major cause of coronary disease, not LDL cholesterol, the indirect marker, but the actual small LDL particles, very peculiar particles, went way up. Blood glucose went way up. Hemoglobin A1C went way up. C-reactive protein went way up. Blood pressure went up. I personally gained a bunch of fat in my waist. My triglycerides went to 390 milligrams. My HDL dropped to 27. I became a type 2 diabetic on that program. I called Dr. Warner. I said, hey, I'm not seeing what you're seeing. In fact, I'm seeing deterioration of health. He says, well, you're eating too many white flour products. I said, no, we're not. We've instructed patients very clearly. No white flour products, only whole grains, multigrain. No fats, no butter, cut the fat, don't eat meat, right? All those things. And yet we're seeing dramatic deterioration of health. We almost came to blows over the phone. but it became clear that a vegetarian, low-fat lifestyle is a very destructive. Now, what he says, I said, well, how do you explain this explosion in triglycerides, small LDL, hemoglobin A1C? I mean, all the markers we know are not good. He says, well, they don't mean the same thing if you're low-fat. And I said, you made that up. There's no such evidence to say, well, those bad things are bad only if you consume fat. That is an absolute fiction. He made that up.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, as we get closer to the end, I want to talk about some big, big longevity splurge. It's a focus now, and everyone's chasing the fountain of youth, NAD boosters, urolithin A, resveratrol. I mean, supplements, they're just anti-aging arsenal when you walk in there. So much noise out there, it's hard to know what's legitimate. Tell us, you're Mr. Encyclopedia, Dr. Davis, any approved supplements or foods that could genuinely help slow the hands of time?
I prefer to talk about being healthy for as long as you can, what some would call health span, because I think the world of longevity is to a great degree a fraud. So Dr. David Sinclair, you may know, at Harvard, who got a lot of publicity for his resveratrol conversation about 15 years ago, saying it would extend life. All cancer, heart disease, and dementia will go away, according to him, by this taking this one thing, right? Of course, that all fell apart. No one could corroborate his science. It turned out to be, if not outright fraud, at least inaccurate. Well, then he comes back out again with this NMN idea that if you replace this one factor in the Krebs cycle for mitochondrial energy production, and he actually said this, we will do away with all dementia, heart disease, and cancer. Now, wait a minute. So we're going to ignore toxic exposures, lack of vitamin D, exercise, microplastics. In other words, it is incredibly silly and oversimplistic. And yet he sold that idea to GlaxoSmithKline for $742 million, started a company called Sirtuis Pharmaceuticals based on this idea that sirtuins are the key to longevity. Well, nobody could reproduce his data. It became clear. So a lot of his colleagues have cut ties with him. I'm surprised he's still employed at Harvard. Maybe there's some kind of contractual thing. I don't know. But it's clear that a lot of it was not true and perhaps fraudulent. I was at the A4M meeting about a year ago, and I was shocked that despite all this, he was the keynote speaker, and a lot of our colleagues were speaking, talking about his science and related science. So I liken those ideas. that we're going to supplement coenzyme Q10, lipoic acid, methylene blue, all those participants in mitochondrial energy production. To me, it's like saying, Dr. Friedman, if you want more power, horsepower out of your car, top the gas tank up. And you would say, well, that's stupid. That doesn't make your car go faster or make it have more horsepower. Same thing. If all you do is increase a substrate or collection of substrates, you might have some positive effects. And here's something to bear in mind for your listeners. What factor common in the human U.S. population do we know with good confidence impairs mitochondrial energy production, kills mitochondria, impairs mitophagy? Endotoxemia. In other words, we're going to try to top up the engine in the hopes that it generates longevity, which it almost is almost guaranteed not to. And we're going to ignore factors that dominate and damage health in so many ways. So impairs mitochondrial energy production and mitochondrial biogenesis. It also impairs insulin resistance, blood pressure, cognitive health. In other words, what I'm trying to encourage everybody to do is focus on the things that really do matter and don't go after somebody who's trying to make money by selling you some fraudulent collection of ideas. And I've heard people say things like, I'm going to live to 180 years old. As you know, we'd be lucky to extend life by 4 weeks.
Right. Well said. So there's no magic pill out there. It's a whole conglomerating system, as you well do in your book. Boy, time flies by. We've gone out of time again. You're such a mountain of information. It's always a pleasure. And the book out there, folks, I want you to get one. It's excellent. It's called Super Body, a 3-week program to harness the new science of body composition and restore your youthful contours. Fascinating read. Recommend you get one. And you can do that by going to William Davis, MD. .com. And while there, be sure and check out the many resources available, like articles, videos, and his microbiome course. Great info there. And you can follow him on Facebook at Dr. William Davis Health, on Instagram at Dr. Davis Infinite Health, and on X, William Davis MD. And of course, you can follow me on Facebook and X at Dr. David Friedman, on Instagram at Dr. D. Friedman. If you heard Dr. Davis share something today that somebody you know needs to hear, send them a link to this podcast available at TrueYourGoodHealthRadio.com and PodcastHealth.com. And while there, peruse our podcast library and share these segments of interest to friends, family, coworkers, and on social media. You always hear me say, don't be selfish, sharing is caring. You can also subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. More to come. Stay tuned and stay well.